Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast.
This week...
Yes, it's Brexit again, kids. We talk about the EU withdrawal bill.
You ask us, what makes a good minister?
And finally, should the Lib Dems just pack up and go home? So, Stephen, let's talk about Brexit. Yeah. Tell me, what's happening with the old EU withdrawal bill this week?
I mean, this will be official by the time this arrives in listeners'
ears. Brains.
The government is delaying the beginning of the committee stage of the EU withdrawal bill.
Wow.
Effectively, because it has so many amendments on it.
So it's a bit like an old Christmas tree, and basically it's just had a lot of baubles hung on it, and at any point it might kind of just... critical mass has been achieved, and it's now just unwieldy and impossible.
Yeah, essentially. And the other hilarious difficulty is that the government is going to have to, at some point, get this through the Lords, where it has no majority, can't control the timetable, and at every defeat, it pings back to the Commons. It can't use the Parliament Act because the EU withdrawal bill needs to have... Well, I mean, this is actually the slightly... I think slight missing fact from the EU withdrawal bill debate, right? Isn't the EU withdrawal bill... means, you know, does not really facilitate, you know, we are leaving regardless. What it facilitates is the ending of EU law being automatically incorporated into British law. Seeing as that will happen anyway during the period of transition, actually, the bill doesn't need to necessarily pass right away. The slight weirdness about the fact the government has got into a pickle over the EU withdrawal bill is, one, it validates the argument for having an early election. Their majority was not big enough before, and it's certainly not big enough now. Of course, the problem was that she
should have won that early election. Yeah.
However, what has basically happened is two people did something exceptionally stupid on the 9th of June. The first person to do something exceptionally stupid was Yvette Cooper, who wrote a piece in The Guardian saying that what was needed was a cross-party commission on Brexit. The second person to do something incredibly stupid was Theresa May, who didn't go, oh, wait, have you decided you'd also like to take responsibility for this mess? Great idea.
Yeah, because this big lake of blood, would you like to dip your hands in it at all?
Yeah, but so if you want a soft Brexit, it is a sensible strategy. If you are someone who wants action on the free movement of labour, which just compels a fairly drastic breach... it is just such a strange... But the weird thing is that from the Conservative perspective, they really should have bitten that off with both hands and just gone, oh, yeah, we'll have a kind of grand... You know, that we'll have a Conservative government for everything else, but we'll effectively have a grand coalition to negotiate this once-in-a-lifetime thing.
It's a fascinating question about whether or not they would have got that past their own... Because there is such a, like, hair trigger among the kind of Brexit elite of the betrayal narrative, and whether or not they actually, although they should have been very much in favour of this because it would have helped them achieve their goals, would have seen this as being a conspiracy to derail it, and, you know, Labour are going to hold this up and blah, 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 and we're going to mire it, and actually what we should just do is ram it through the Commons with our massive muscles. Again, another reason to have an early election that you win. But I think it's got to an interesting stage now in the debate where it's, you know, there has been a little bit of movement in the polls, but I'm really intrigued to know if anything will actually make anybody change their mind, because to me it just seems it's not really an argument about Brexit anymore. It's become a cultural argument, something much, much deeper. But you wrote in your column this week about this idea about the fact that the really sad thing about this is that there is a Brexit out there that would satisfy almost everybody, right?
Yeah, so the argument I make in the column this week, and it's an argument that's been advanced to me by several people in the European Commission and several people who know the EU's internal processes well in domestic politics, right? Then if you are the EU, the central thing that you can't have is a situation in which people start approaching EU membership like a buffet. But equally, if you're the EU, you know that Brexit is bad for everyone. It's particularly bad for the United Kingdom, and it's also bad for the economic prosperity of the rest of the EU. And it's in your interests to have as close a trade relationship as possible. But the UK has to, if not lose out from the process, at least has to pay a price that it's not easy for, say, Hungary to also pay. And so the argument sort of several people made is, what are the things that the EU would have liked from Britain before Brexit? One, for the City of London to come under the control of the European Central Bank, because there's this slight weirdness that the European Union's and the Eurozone's major financial services hub is not within the Eurozone, but in several important ways it kind of is. So one, you kind of go, yes, we will cede control over that. Two, you become a rule taker, not a rule maker. You just follow all regulation that comes out of the EU. Three, you pay more in as a net contribution than you do now. And then this effectively allows you a situation where you have the same level of market access, but you don't have the free movement of people. Because although that is economically not great for Britain not to have the free movement of people, it isn't great for other countries not to have access to the British labour market. It is, however, less of an economic blow than the only available alternative. Now, it may be that these people on the EU side and the British side are being too optimistic. However, seeing as the government is at the moment putting a lot of time and effort into a magical customs union which doesn't force you to have a hard border at Northern Ireland, it is a bit... I mean, the slightly sad thing about Brexit, right, is it's in the Labour Party's interest for Brexit to go really badly, just in a short-term way. I mean, I think in its long-term interest, it is very much not in their interest for it to go really badly. But in the short term, it's in their interest. The weird and slightly tragic thing is actually it's not in the Conservative Party's interests to have a Brexit about its weird personal obsessions. That's incredibly dangerous to the Conservative Party in both the medium and long term. And yet, and it's also incredibly bad for everyone who has to live here.
Well, just to pick up something else that's happened this week, I was really impressed to see a bit of effective opposition politics from Jeremy Corbyn, who went in very hard last week at Prime Minister's Questions on the Universal Credit phone line charging 55p a minute. And actually, it just became indefensible. Like, he did the thing that we've always talked about. Instead of these sort of vague kind of, Theresa May, are you against bad things? Are you for good things? He picked a specific thing that they could hammer away at. And this week, David Gawk, who's the Work and Pension Secretary, had to go up in front of the committee, the select committee involved, and try and defend it, and therefore decided basically that he couldn't. So there was a concession ahead of Prime Minister's Questions. Now, this is something, obviously, we've got much deeper problems with universal credit than this, and some of the stories that are coming out are really, truly, really grim. But there is no doubt that this is something that would have made people's lives a lot worse that has now, because of effective opposition, been dropped. So I just wanted to give a big shout out to the big JC. I know I've been tough on him on the past, but I think this one Labour played really, really well. And it does speak to me as well about that they're getting better at finding the pressure points on stuff that they care about, right? And obviously you don't see that with Brexit because, as you say, it's more in their interest just to say, you know, fill your boots, lads, let's see how you do on this one. Stephen, I've got a question for you. There seems to be a bit of a thing now where a certain type of, maybe you could call them a centrist dad if we weren't banned from using such outrageous insults on this podcast, you know, a certain type of centrist commentator becomes very alarmed about the fact that Labour and the Tories have such similar Brexit positions in terms of leaving the single market, that kind of thing, and tries to make a new centrist party happen. For whatever value of centrist. I know I've written about how it's often a very woolly word. But there is the Lib Dems. And why does everyone hate the Lib Dems? And can they ever make them stop hating the Lib Dems, is my question.
I mean, as like the kind of weird lone defender of the... I feel like there's this kind of weird...
Well, tell us what you're the lone defender of.
The weird lone defender of the word centrist.
I mean, like the word neoliberal, isn't it? I mean, this was the whole point when I wrote about it, is there is a specific set of policies or ideology you could call neoliberal, and then it just drifted into being something vaguely capitalist that I don't like. And my problem with the word centrist was always the way it was used by a certain kind of Labour lefty to mean everybody wasn't either actually goose-stepping or them.
So I think there are two objections I have to the way it is sometimes used now. One is it gets conflated, including by actual centrists, with the electorally lucrative common ground, or whatever you want to call it, right? But, like, self-evidently, like, there is a middle ground between John McDonnell's fiscal rule and Philip Hammond's fiscal rule. I mean, actually, in that case, Philip Hammond's fiscal rule is silly, right? There's actually, McDonnell's fiscal rule makes a great deal of sense. But there is quite a lot of space between those two fiscal rules. Self-evidently, there is a, one of them is more left-wing, one of them is more right-wing. I can't really see what the electoral space is for a position between the two of them, but nonetheless, there is obviously a centrist position. But yeah, it is slightly fascinating that there is this new Radicals party. There was a party profiled in the FT called Renew. Joe Mourne had his party Spring the Party. there's another one. And the slightly hilarious thing about it, right, is if you are looking at the big two political parties and you're going, oh, what I would like is someone a bit more compassionate than the Conservatives, a bit more into the market than Labour. So, I mean, guess, guys, it's called the SNP. Or, failing that, the Lib Dems, right? And seeing as what that's what these people sort of say they want, right, is that, and plus they're both more pro-European.
Yeah, I just think the fascinating thing about the Lib Dems is I think maybe they did more damage to themselves, or were damaged more in the last election than perhaps we even realised, by Tim Farron's socially conservative views, because there was a great talk by John Curtis talking about the Labour-Conservative split and saying actually the economic argument is no longer the one that really, this election didn't really animate voters, or it was not the choice that they made in terms of left-wing, right-wing. Actually, it was a values election and about social liberalism. And I think that's the thing that really nerfed them, is I don't think there's a space for the Lib Dems if they're not socially liberal, right? That's just not the pool of people that they're fishing in. There are no socially conservative centrists. Like, the kind of person who cares about being in the single market is also fine with gay marriage, right? That's just a thing.
Yeah, the overlap between I like the single market, I like equal marriage is entirely... Yeah,
it's just a circle.
It is just a circle. So I think there are a couple of problems. So I am doing my kind of big piece about
what you got
2017,
wrong.
No, that will come at the end of the year. My big piece about what the electoral battleground looks like after the 2017 election. Obviously, I did that after the 2015 election. A bunch of people who agreed that the Labour defeat was so bad in 2015 that the best result they could get was what they got this time have now decided, because they don't like Corbyn, that actually the 2015 election wasn't that bad. So the main reason why I'm doing it is so whatever the result in 2022 is, I can't I can't go, oh, actually, if I mean, because like, Labour really ought to win the next election when you just look at the pattern,
look at the fundamental
seats.
Well, also, I just, do you know, I had this terrible thought this morning, and I may have just, you know, rendered us all completely redundant. I just thought, is it maybe just the case that you just need a certain amount of time to pass so that everything that's gone wrong in the economy or the country, everything that people don't like, they just blame the current government for it, and then it just takes a while to get through the circle, and then they just blame the new government for it, and then it just repeats forever?
I think the difficulty with that theory, though, is it doesn't quite explain 1992.
Ah, interesting.
Or indeed 59. Right, so there are lots of elections.
But you know what I mean? I watched Jeremy Corbyn, or rather I read about Jeremy Corbyn at PMQs, you know, landing the economy blows, landing the DUP. You know, I think it just... I suppose it doesn't really explain the 80s either. You know, at some point there's just an accumulation of enough crap that you can throw at the government that it becomes very hard.
Yeah, I think there are...
shake it off.
But the interesting thing in terms of what has gone wrong for the Lib Dems, so I was looking at the map, and the Lib Dem election result is so much worse than it looks at first. There are only 48 seats in which they are second. Of those 48, there are only 7 in which they are within 5,000 votes.
Ouch.
Of the incumbent party.
Their money situation, I presume, is not brilliant.
Although people are joining and they are the third party again by vote, so, you know, there are sort of, you know, things are looking up in a way for them. I mean, my instinct, and this is probably unfair because I always feel that whenever I have an uncharitable reading of why someone does something, it turns out it's wrong, and I'm innately sceptical of bad faith arguments, but I kind of feel that the Let's Up a New Party is kind of for people who look at the fact and, right, so if you're really concerned about the direction of the government's EU policy, actually, the most viable way of fixing it is to join the Conservative Party, right? There are only 100,000 of them, right? There's a good chance that Theresa May is going to collapse at any given moment, right? You wouldn't need that many Remainers to suddenly mean that the next Tory leader could go, I hear the EEA is lovely this time of year, right? If that's the change you really want to bring about, right?
I really like the idea we might do great movie quotes, but replacement EEA. Like, I love the smell of the EEA in the morning.
If that is what you want to do, that is significantly more effective than hoping that Spring the Party, the Radicals, Renew, the Cabbage Patch Kids, or whatever one of the next silly one of these parties to emerge is going to catch on. And ditto, although the Lib Dems have got a really awful electoral map, that is probably, like, trying to recover from that is a better bet than, you know, the negative effects of first past the post. But I kind of feel that setting up a new centrist party is a really good way of feeling better about... It's kind of the sort of... It's the token equivalent going, well, I tried. I've put something forward.
In a weird way, I wonder if it isn't also a version of the thing that Corbynism has already been an attack for, which is purity politics, which is I don't want to share my tent with anybody who I don't... You know, I don't have all the same beliefs as, right? And I think that's an interesting point as well, is just actually, are you happy to work within the existing structures, or do you want a party that's just for you and people like you? If you were going to have a centrist party that you were going to found, what would you call it?
I mean, in terms of what would be a cool name, or yeah, just in terms of its electoral... I mean, I think if you're going to do a new centrist party, just call it Stop Brexit, right? Because the bet, right, that these parties are making electorally, and indeed that the Lib Dems under Tim Farron kind of made and are still making, is that it will go sufficiently badly that at the next election, whenever it is, a non-trivial number of people, and okay, admittedly in this election, that non-trivial number of people, even though they didn't vote Labour, they tended to help Labour. Kensington and Battersea are both quite good examples of places where the Labour vote does go up, but the big story isn't the Tory vote dissolves to various sort of Brexit-blocking entities. The bet you're making if your new centre party is going to be successful, right, is that Brexit will be bad, the two parties will be seen as being hand in glove, and that at that point, you know, step forward everyone's favourite windmill-based lawyer to sweep all before him, right? That, so you might as well just, if seeing as you are, that is the bet you're making, you might as well just, like, go with that. So yeah, just call it Stop Brexit.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Right, and now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
It's actually a really good question this week.
They're all good questions, Stephen. We love all of our listeners equally. But this one...
This one I love a little bit more. It's from Nick Humphrey. And it's two things. One, who we think the rising stars of each party are. But I think actually the bit of the question I really like is if you might also explain a bit about how you go about working out who is actually any good. And the point that he makes, there's a very good piece that Isabel Hardman wrote a while back about, actually, when Jeremy Brown was sacked, and a bunch of people in the lobby went, oh, this is awful.
Lib Dem Foreign Office Minister at the time.
Was at Home Office at the time. And everyone in the Home Office was just like, he was crap. And also, I mean, he was the Lib Dem Home Office Minister, and seeing as the Lib Dem Junior Coalition Ministers had basically two jobs, right, they were told to do one of, and ideally two things, right? Firstly, have your own project so we can go look in coalition.
We did X.
We made it easier for people to adopt. And then secondly, just don't let anything crazy happen. Jeremy Brown had no project in the Home Office, but he was the Home Office Minister during the time of the Go Home bans, and that was literally his brief as well. And the fascinating thing is I always get my Nicks mixed
up. In a twist.
So, or is it my Foster's? My Don's mixed up, right? Yeah. Either Don Baker or Don Foster.
No,
or
it's Norman Baker.
Norman Baker. The one who thinks that Richard Kelly was murdered.
David Kelly was murdered.
Right.
He thinks. I'm just saying, I'm not. That's not what I'm saying.
Norman Baker. Right. Now, so yes, Norman Baker.
MP for Lewis, as was.
Thinks a lot of outlandish things and also has a record that you can listen to on Spotify. But the reason why Theresa May vanished from leadership contention in terms of the topic of regular discussion in mid-2014 is until 2014 she had Jeremy Brown going around lunching a bunch of journalists and talking about the future of liberalism. And then from 2014 to 2015 she had Foster/Baker. I don't understand why I can't, you know, it's just one of those weird names where literally it just slides from my brain.
I had the Norman Foster, Norman Fowler, one of them being a peer, one of them being an architect, horror too. But yeah, you're right. I think of that as the Michael Gove gambit, which is that you heard lots of stuff about Michael Gove, mostly because departments that Michael Gove is in tend to leak. Who knows how that could happen? Who can say what strange process it might be? I mean, it was in journalists' interests to be flattering about him and his projects because he was a really brilliant source.
Yes, I think...
I mean, bless him, now that he's in agriculture, it turns out even the great, great leaky gossip of Michael Gove is not enough to get people interested.
It's actually quite simple. It actually is doing quite a good job at DEFRA.
Yeah, well, but you know what I mean? It turns out there is a limit to what you can get lobby journalists' interest, and, you know, neonicotinoid pesticides are it.
So the tragedy is that the way that people decide who rising stars are tend to be based on someone who gave good quotes at a lunch, someone who has a similar sense of humour, someone who I have the same non-political interests as.
And the big unmentioned one, the person that everybody agrees. I mean, that's the thing, is that there is a phenomenal herding instinct about political journalism, right? It's even more than, you know, theatre or film reviewing. Being an outlier and being the one person who says, I think X is crap that everyone else loves, or I think X is... And Diane Abbott, right? It's the fact that saying that Diane Abbott is an effective politician is still the kind of thing that gets you kind of...
As reluctant as I am to say this, when I'm quite literally within throttling distance of my boss, but, you know, when I'm not in the office, right, with the rest of the lobby, and you're like, oh, what's the line on this, right? If I go, oh, I think the line on the EU withdrawal bill collapsing is X, right? And it turns out everyone else thinks it's Y, I looked off, right? But if I turn to, like, you know, Ash at the Independent, I go, what do you think the line on this is, right? Well,
we can't
be proved wrong, because
it's the same
all
way
of
that
the lefty press has taken the same line on it.
Newspapers get obsessed about whether or not, when they look at the first editions come in, about whether or not there are stories that other people have missed, which is something that always used to baffle me. It was the idea that, you know, just because it's a good story for another newspaper doesn't necessarily mean it's a good story for your market. So actually, you know, why don't you have the kind of confidence to say, I looked at all these stories and I made the best selection for our readers, and that the fact that it's on the front page of The Guardian doesn't really change that. But you're right, it is always a... And particularly from a left-wing perspective, I think that is something that always sort of skews it slightly, because it's harder to make a case for a left-wing person being good, right? Just simply because there's a sort of reflexive kind of about them, that you have to go against the pack to say that.
Yeah. So I'm trying to kind of develop a theory of how it is I assess whether or not politicians are any good, right? And the slightly weird thing is that the skill set of being a good minister and a good opposition politician and good in the House of Commons and a good leader... There are some overlaps, but they are actually all sufficiently different that it's quite easy to assess, I think, whether or not someone is a good opposition politician, right? You know, are they good at finding stress points in the government? Do they, like, run their constituency office well? Yeah, the kind of the metrics are quite easy to grade.
Yeah, do they have their CLP on side? You know, is their contact rate good with constituents? I think all that stuff's really important. I mean, like, I go back a lot to the Harriet Harman book, where she did lots of work on NHS waiting times, and basically said anybody below this line is going to die before they get their operation. And just being able to find simple ways of framing issues like that to attack the government on is really important. But ministers are different, because, I mean, there's a great Radio 4 series interviewing people who now sort of left public life about what makes a good minister. And there is a thing of where Michael Gove used to call Liz Truss his hand grenade, right? And that's one model of it. You've got to just kind of go in and bulldoze your thing that you want doing. And actually, Michael Gove, and certainly Dominic Cummings, as his pad, took that to an extreme degree, where they basically just saw the civil service as, you know, wastrels who were going to block their genius. And that's very much not how the civil service saw it. But you do need a certain kind of, I'm here to do this job, and this is who I am. I'm a single purpose, you know, I've just got to hammer it through.
I mean, but this is where the kind of question of, and this is why I think it's much more difficult to assess people on the government side, partly because you have to start grading weirdly on this kind of incredibly sort of dependent curve. So let's take the Blair Brown era, right? Where in an odd way, being a minister with projects was not that great a way to survive, because to have a project was at some point to make a choice between
Blair
Tony
and Brown.
And Gordon,
yeah,
which
and
was
also,
to end
yeah.
yourself, right? Which means in an odd way, one of the reasons why that generation of leadership candidates who'd come up to the cabinet in 2015 were so bad is that being a
they
good
were the survivors
was,
of an era in which the tall poppies were ruthlessly sliced off. Yeah. I also think there's a thing where you get with league tables of surgeons and stuff like that, for example, where one of the problems you have is if you're like a really specialist, like a paediatric heart surgeon or something like that, actually having a high death rate is not necessarily a sign that you're just sewing scissors into people all the time. It might well also be a sign that you are given more difficult things to do. You take on edge cases. It's a really big problem in America, obviously, because, you know, if you want to be a cosmetic surgeon or a brain surgeon, would you take on the highly experimental cases? Would you want to take on, you know, or do you want to go into a much more lucrative area like a cosmetic surgery where you can bang through 15 nose jobs a day or whatever?
And then to have our kind of third.
But that's the same thing
of,
with ministers, yeah, right? Yeah. Is that you kind of, you know, if you're Michael Fallon and you're minister for the Today programme, or David Gawk and that weird phrase they keep going, uncork the gawk, which makes me feel always like I slightly want to hit myself in the face, you're sent out to do the tough things.
Yeah, and your departmental job is effectively an excuse to have someone who, when the BBC goes, who are you getting to defend this? And they're like, David Gawk, they kind of can't go, well, we don't want him, because they have to accept him. And
Caroline Flint was a very, yeah, in the previous
well,
era,
this is
was
what Barry Gardner gives the, yeah, the leadership now.
It's a kind of solid defence.
Yeah. David Gawk, I think, is a really good example of the difficulty of assessing someone, right? Because now, obviously, universal credit is a disaster, right? However, it was...
It's not David Gawk's disaster.
It's a disaster than you know, we as a magazine, The Guardian, in the various people, BuzzFeed, have been shouting about for a long time. It obviously reflects very badly as Ian Duncan-Smith's job as a Secretary of State. David Gawk has been sent there effectively to diffuse the row. Now, I actually think, in some ways, I've suddenly realised David Gawk is a bad example of this. I think David Gawk has then been quite a bad minister on that metric, because he
has not diffused the
row.
Well, David Lyddington's maybe a better example.
Yeah, David Lyddington.
Injustice, because actually prisons are in a terrible, creaky old state, and you get a new report almost every week about some jail that's horrible, and it's got, yeah, overcrowded cells and stuff like that. And yet somehow that's not ever... You know, at some point, I think hopefully it will break through. But
and then the other difficulty with ministers is, I mean, so for example, David Lyddington, you know, what's his face? Chris Grayling, terrible minister, just objectively appalling minister. That thing is actually, I feel it's easier to tell if someone's good on the opposition side, unless easy to tell if they're bad. And on the ministerial side, it's quite easy to decide, yeah, they're rubbish, but it's quite hard to tell if they are good or circumstantially good, yada, yada, yada.
Or they're just lucky to have a really great department that's all happy, a great permanent secretary.
The other metric I've started using is staff retention, because if you can't retain and keep your staff, you probably can't run a successful department. I mean, there were many reasons why Theresa May's the election collapsed as it did. But one of them is that she had a climate of fear, which is why so many civil servants were unhappy and why it used to leak so badly. And it meant that people couldn't say things like, yeah, please stop glaring at people on TV.
But
yeah,
that's fascinating, because that's the difference between Prime Minister and Cabinet Minister, right? Is that her civil servants at the Home Office liked her a lot more.
But that's just because of the Home... I mean, this is the bit where you can tell I spend too long hanging out with people who work at the Treasury and the Foreign Office, because I was about to go, that's just because they're all thick racists, and I suddenly was just like, wow, I've imbibed the Treasury propaganda. But the kind of less glib way of putting it is that there is a very Home Office view of the world that attracts its senior civil servants, which she completely shared. So her inflexibility wasn't a problem. She was a square peg in a square hole.
But they also liked how hard she worked. And you, yeah, might say that's because the Home Office, as you say, are a bit Hufflepuff, let's be honest with you.
I mean, isn't it Slytherin who are the racists?
But I just feel they're the sort of hard-working duffers.
Yeah, it's true. They are honest duffers.
And I'm sure that, and you know, some of my best friends work at the Home Office. Actually, it does. But I'm not so. Not...
Several people from the Home Office subscribe to, yeah, the morning email.
Hashtag not everybody at the Home Office.
Yeah, not
is
all
a,
Home Office.
It's a duffer slash racist. But I'm sure you have several colleagues that you know that's true.
But yeah, I think that's why she did so well there.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by Indie Book and produced by Caroline Crampton. Why not check out our sister podcast? There is The Back Half from the Culture Team, Seriously from Caroline and Anna, and also Skylines from City Metric. You can find them all on iTunes or your podcast provider of choice.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.